Welcome to another episode of Lean and Mean. I'm your host, Judy, and today we have Dr. Kushner, a seasoned dentist, sharing his expertise on the mechanics of dental exams and patient communication. Dr. Kushner, thanks for joining us.
Again, thanks for having me.
So if you don't mind, Dr. Kushner, I would love if we could get back into the new patient interview where we left off.
I would like to. Again, this is the short 5-minute, ideally, new patient interview. We have series of a few questions that we consider pretty much mandatory, and we really want to do this on every single new patient that comes through the door. I ask every adult new patient, what's concerning him or her most? If it concerns the patient, and ultimately he or she's willing to pay for it, it concerns me. No matter how we treatment plan a case, we must address the primary concern in one way or another relatively early in treatment. You're going to piss them off. If we're not going to treat the primary concern early in treatment, we need to explain why. Many times, we do not or do not want to treat the primary concern first thing. If we constantly treat primary concern first thing, all too often, they don't come back for complete care or treatment. But we can't ignore primary concern. You ignore primary concern, it could make patients really angry really quickly. We need to at least address it.
That makes sense. Sounds right.
Question number two, maybe. I ask how long it's been since they've seen the dentist. And I don't lecture. Patient knows he's been negligent, so why make him feel worse? I tell the patient that I'm just glad I finally got you in here. There's no need to make you feel worse. Just trying to get some history. If it has been several years since the last visit, I may now ultimately use that against the patient in the treatment plan. If it's been several years since the last visit, I'll ask politely, I might, what has kept them away for so long? It's usually fear of pain or expense. And all dentists know, or should know, the three big barriers to dental care are fear of pain, expense, and time.
I can certainly relate to that.
If it's been fairly recent since the last visit, I investigate that even more carefully. For example, why'd you leave your last dentist, or when did you see your last dentist? I tell them the truth. I want to keep you in my practice, in our practice. So if we can avoid what the last dentist did to make you leave his or her practice, by golly, I'll do that. So tell me what happened.
That's great.
I want to ask about cosmetics. Are you happy with the way your mouth looks when you smile? To see if they want to lead me into a cosmetics discussion. I always ask about third molars. I ask about the wisdom teeth. Do you have your wisdom teeth? Did you have them removed? Are they in your mouth? Did a dentist ever suggest they be removed? Is there any discomfort back in the corners?
Important questions.
We ask if their gum tissues give them any trouble. Do they bleed? Is there a bad taste in your mouth? Do you use dental floss? We've used for decades a written survey which includes these types of questions about the patient's own perception of their periodontal health. A series of questions like this is generally enough to get your patient talking and give us a pretty good idea what we're dealing with. We may treatment plan two very similar mouths completely differently based on what we learn in that little 5-minute initial interview.
That fast, with the right questions. I mean, that's great.
We should have timed it. Of course, I didn't get answers from you, but that would give us a good feel for that 5-minute goal. Two different patients, as an example, exhibit 4 or 5 virtually very, very similar interproximal lesions. Let's say this is going to be technical. Just reaching the DEJ and the bite wings. In the interview, the first patient told me that he's seen his last dentist every 6 months for the past several years, and he feels he should be in pretty good shape. The only reason he left his previous dentist is that he moved to our part of town. But he really did like and respect his previous dentist. I'm going to tell this patient that there appear to be a few tiny areas between some teeth that could someday become real cavities. We'll call them watches on our chart, and we'll look at them every 6 months to make sure they don't get any worse or to try to prevent them from getting any worse. But keep our eye on them, and we'll deal with them as we need to.
So you're instilling confidence and trust in everything you do.
Yes, but I'm making a contrast from the second patient in the example with similar clinical findings, at least caries-wise, at least cavity-wise. I learn in his or her initial interview that it's been 3 or 4 years since the last dental visit. And this patient says point blank, "Doc, I'm sure I got some cavities by now." Well, I'll diagnose all the caries in this mouth as needing restoration as soon as it can be arranged. Both of those treatment plans are perfectly acceptable. Both patients feel I'm a capable dentist. Both will be satisfied with the service and will keep both as patients. And although in different ways, in the long run, we've maximized our profits on both those patients. Give your patients what they want, they'll give you what you want. Dental patients are not equal. Do not treat them equally. That leads to kind of a side comment that I make often, and I'm not sure I will in this series. And that's this. All of your patients deserve your respect equally. They do not all deserve your time equally.
I love the approach of respecting every patient equally, but what about when it comes to insurance?
Yeah, of course, it's everywhere. We haven't really even talked about it much, but dentists know, believe me. This is the real world, and we need to take advantage of our patients' benefits. The patient's insurance has very, very much to do with the treatment plan you present for him at this time. I've concluded the patients don't really care what my philosophy of dentistry is, so the patients aren't interested in what we have to say. They're worried about what's going to happen to them. I close the interview with something like, "Today's just our fact-finding visit. We'll examine your entire mouth, take the necessary films. Now, we're not pushy. I'll be happy if I can just examine your mouth, study your films, and present to you our findings as well as what we think should be done. If you don't like what I have to say, that's fine. We'll only do what you want. We can still be your friends, and I can still be your dentist. I can assure you that all details concerning your care and any expense involved will be discussed with you before any treatment begins."
So you can end the conversation without ending the relationship?
Yes, of course. Always keep that open. And then I'd ask her if she has any questions for me before we went back to take a look. I'd like to give them a chance to get anything else off their chest before we go to the clinical setting.
So where do the remainder of these conversations take place once you head back?
Well, we're going to go to the clinical setting. I'm often asked if it's okay. That's the chair side, the dental chair. I'm often asked if it's okay if we do initial interview at chair side because my private office is a mess or we just don't have room. And I always say, well, it's better at chair side than not at all, but I would prefer a setting away from the clinical setting if at all possible. At the chair side, patients tend to want to show you things in their mouth. Some of them will even try to show us things across the desk in the private office. And we prefer at this point they be telling us things, not showing us things. So for that reason, if at all possible, I would prefer some privacy away from the clinical setting.
Personally, I think I'd rather be in private myself. There are a lot of distractions chair side. And if people have dental anxiety, it seems like the less time in the chair, the better.
Nervous patients actually relax when they hear what we'll be doing on that first visit. Notice I haven't mentioned the prophy fee, and I won't if I don't have to. At any rate, when I do ask the patient if he or she has any questions for me prior to the clinical exam, occasionally they'll pick up on the fact that I didn't mention the prophy. And they'll ask me, "Aren't you going to clean my teeth today?" And I usually simply tell the truth and see how it goes. Many of our new patients haven't had their teeth cleaned for several years, and I wanted to schedule the appropriate amount of time. What I'm really saying is we're not going to hack away at three-year-old calculus for an hour for a single profi fee. If this confrontation is to happen, I prefer it happening face-to-face with the doctor and not over the telephone, where it's too easy to put down the phone and call the next dentist. An extremely valuable technique is to answer a patient's objection before they have a chance to make the objection. Answer the objection before they have a chance to even think of it.
Gotcha. So you're always a step ahead thinking of that before they even know.
Yeah, we must discipline ourselves to get into that initial interview room for that five-minute deal. You can gain a wealth of information in a short period of time, and if you learn how to use it, you got the game won. For example, I have a guy that describes some major dental problems, and I see on his information he's unemployed. Believe me, this happens all the time. Has no dental insurance. Sorry for saying this, but it looks kind of scruffy. So I'm going to confront this guy in the interview. Gee, Bill, you're describing some pretty extensive dental problems. Dentistry's gotten a little more expensive over the years. Have you made any provision for expense? Right to it. I went right to it, and I'll use his reply appropriately. He might not be a candidate for elective dentistry. Now, I want to know that before I get in very deep. I still love him, I do. And maybe for very little money, or even I might choose no money at all, I can patch something up here or there, put out a couple of fires, but I need to know that before I get in very deep. Maybe even before we complete our exam and get the films.
Interesting. Let's dive into the details of the clinical exam. You mentioned a talkover technique. How does that work and why do you use it?
Absolutely. The talkover technique is a way to communicate with my assistant sitting on the other side of the patient's head, talking over the patient, across the patient, while conducting the exam, without actually directly addressing the patient. But we want the patient to be relatively aware of our findings as we go along without a direct addressing to the patient. For instance, if we find severe periodontal conditions, instead of throwing around numbers, which we'll gather, we just won't throw them around necessarily verbally. We describe the situation using terms the patient can understand, like red, inflamed, puffy, maybe even the words like infected. So we know and we want that the patient is eavesdropping on our conversation, but not directly involved in the conversation. Their mouth is open.
That makes sense. And how about the flip side of the talkover technique, when the patient might be anxious about certain procedures?
Exactly. Very, very true. If the patient is worried about, let's say, a root canal, most are, I might just drop a subtle hint to my assistant, like endopossible number 4, and then review the films later to confirm. It's about being sensitive to the patient's concerns and addressing them appropriately still.
Great. Now, you mentioned a routine for the exam. Can you walk us through the order you follow?
Sure. And I don't do a lot of clinical instruction. I really don't. But this is what I've always done. It goes back to dental school. I typically start with the nodes, check the TMJ, soft tissue oral cancer check. Then I move on to perio charting, occlusal, maybe ortho classification, and assessing missing teeth. I don't chart all existing restorations, but I will focus on charting existing cast restorations, crowns, bridges. Finally, I evaluate for caries, fractures, and any necessary treatment restorations, ending the exam by requesting, in my case, a full series of films, and that helps set the stage for further diagnosis. I might leave the clinical exam by giving a brief summary of the clinical findings up to that point to the patient. For example, I may say something like, Bill, looks like you do have a bit of a decay problem. Couple teeth that appear to be broken and so forth. I don't want to make it official without having seen your film, so let's take a set of films. And if you'll drop in for just 10 minutes or so later this week, I'll go over the details with you. So doctors, if you have any kind of volume in your practice, you're not going to have time to be reviewing films right then. If you can, that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. The patient will stick with you. But if you're like me, you're reviewing them after hours. We're freaking busy. You do need to do a thorough enough clinical exam so that when you combine, it took me decades, Judy, to figure out that this was a problem for so many dentists. You need to do a thorough enough clinical exam so that after hours, when you combine your clinical findings with your film, after the patient has gone home, you have all the information necessary to completely plan your treatment. And I've done it so many thousands and thousands of times. It's like nothing to me. But dentists struggle with that.
So you're combining two different ways and two different findings and into a comprehensive approach. Now, moving on to patient communication after the exam, you mentioned a welcome letter. Could you explain the purpose behind that?
Sure. The welcome letter is a very simple but powerful tool. It's essentially a thank you note, and that can be contrasted to the thank you note to the referring patient as well. I'm not talking about that right now, but they're two different kinds of... Welcome letter is a better term for the note that's going to the new patient. And it's essentially a thank you note that we send to every new patient after they're handwritten. Handwritten creates a positive impression, and the patient receives it ideally before their next visit. It's a way of expressing appreciation and building a connection with the patient.
Handwritten notes will definitely stand out these days. Now, you mentioned the importance of keeping a ledger for new patients. Why is that?
You know, I still do it by hand, and of course we've got the technology to do this, but I carry it around with me. It's just keeping track of new patient flow, and did they get into treatment, and what's the size of the case, and did they get mad, did this, did that, did that. How many new patients this week, this shift, next week, next month? The ledger helps us understand our practice's growth, provides valuable information, especially in the follow-up column. I already mentioned that. It allows us to stay connected with our patients and ensures that we're delivering a positive experience from the first visit forward.
Well, I love that. So, Dr. Kushner, you mentioned the importance of the timing of a new patient referral gift. Can you elaborate on why that matters so much?
Sure. The timing of the new patient referral gift is important, crucial, I might say, because we anticipate that the referring and new patients, pay attention now, will be in touch with each other before the new patient's second visit. We believe that showing appreciation to the referring patient through a gift, simple gift, we'll talk about it in a second, will leave a positive impression on the new patient and contribute to the success of the new patient's case.
That makes sense. And you mentioned sending gifts to the place of employment. Why is that a strategic move?
Sending the gift to the place of employment serves a couple of purposes. First, it's a visible gesture that we think will become a conversation piece among coworkers, spreading the word about our dental office. And secondly, in the case of this particular gift, it's a constant promotional tool for us. For years, we sent flowers or even a bottle of wine, but we find that coffee mugs are cheaper and more effective. They're logoed. They stay on the patient's referring desk with our phone number and serve as a constant reminder to come back and see us.
Well, that's a great reason to transition to coffee mugs. Now let's move ahead and touch on the diagnosis appointment once you've completed that first exam. When do you feel a formal separate diagnosis appointment is necessary?
That's a great question. Because some of the cases are small, they're simple, they don't need this kind of complexity. Not that it's complex, but a separate visit is a bigger deal. And I think probably the best guideline is the financial aspect. Depending on your style of practice, the case fee or copayment is in the $600 or $800 range or greater. Maybe it needs to be in the $1,200 range. Maybe it needs to be in the $300 or $400 range in a lower income clientele practice or greater before you want to sit down and discuss it.
That's a great insight. And you mentioned the importance of the doctor leading by example in handling case presentations. Why is that so crucial?
Well, I firmly believe the doctor who is unwilling to be involved in the financial aspect of his practice is destined for mediocrity at best. It's about establishing trust and a sense of commitment from both the patient and the doctor.
So with that, let's delve into a shortcut or two when a formal diagnosis might not be necessary. Can you share more about that?
Yes, and I tried to emphasize a little while ago, there are going to be a bunch of those. You need to know the whole range, the whole scale of things. There are certainly cases where a full diagnosis might not be needed, like when a patient just needs a simple prophy and an occlusal restoration. In such situations, we can streamline the process without compromising the quality of care by combining diagnosis with treatment or even hygiene appointments. You know, I keep harping on no first visit hygiene, but sometimes it's appropriate. And a first visit start in such a simple case, finances arranged, have the time, might be just great.
That sounds like a practical approach. And you mentioned the importance of keeping the entire case condensed in two visits. How do you achieve that?
Well, we can schedule a short diagnosis along with treatment. Might call that, this is visit two, diagnosis / start visit, or diagnosis / hygiene for that second appointment. This way, we can maintain our efficiency without skipping any of these crucial steps. And again, I want to repeat it. I just don't want it to become a habit. A first visit start can be okay.
Got it. Moving on to the formal diagnosis visit, you mentioned it shouldn't last more than 10 to 15 minutes. What's the reasoning behind that?
Dental patients want to know three things, Judy. The cost, possible pain involved. Again, the answer to that is always should be none. Maybe some post-op soreness, which we'll take care of with medication. And during the duration of treatment, Dental patients want to know three things. The cost, the pain involved, and there shouldn't be any, unless some post-op soreness we can handle with medication, and the duration of the treatment. How long? We try to restrict our diagnosis to addressing these concerns, making it brief and focused on providing the essential information.
That makes sense, keeping it concise and addressing the patient's key concerns. But what about overcoming barriers? You mentioned fear of pain as a significant barrier. How do you address that?
Fear of pain is a common obstacle in getting patients into the office, no question about it. So we reassure them, like all dentists try to do, that all procedures will be done comfortably. Local anesthetic, nitrous oxide if desired, oral tranquilizers maybe.
And finally, Dr. Kushner, you emphasize the battle with the expense barrier. Can you share your approach to addressing this critical and sensitive aspect?
Yes, indeed. This is what it's all about. While fear and time barriers are important, the true battle lies in addressing the expense barrier. I provide a brief, non-technical review of the proposed treatment. Sometimes I ask the patient, this is a little complicated now. I'm in the diagnosis visit, the case presentation visit. And in the previous visit, I didn't really discuss a whole lot with the patient. I did a talkover technique with my assistant. Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
So this is the next visit. I provide a brief non-technical review of the proposed treatment, including the number of visits, duration per visit, and the time between visits. Very often I will say, do you remember the stuff we talked about last time about what's going on in your mouth? I didn't talk about anything with them about what's going on in their mouth. They overheard some things.
Mm-hmm.
9 times out of 10, they'll go, yeah, I remember. And I'm thinking, well, good, I don't have to go through that. Then I present the fee and offer the options for affordable handling of the fees.
Fantastic insights, Dr. Kushner. Let's dive into the business side of dentistry. You mentioned the importance of making a profit and being perfect. Can you elaborate on how dentists can navigate this challenge?
Absolutely. In these coming sessions, we're going to focus on a couple of really pretty deep topics, collection policy and overhead control. I'd like to emphasize that in my days of all-day lectures, these two topics would be several hours, like two-thirds of a day on these two topics. So we've pared it down, but we've kept to the important points, and we hope it'll be easy to follow, and you'll still get all the good stuff out of it without taking all day to do it. Dentistry is a business, and we need to ensure profitability while striving for, and I hesitate to say this, but trying for perfection in our work. We go too far towards perfection in this profession, and that's another set of problems. However, the focus should always be on the patient. Success is about what's in it for the patient, not the dentist.
That's an interesting perspective. So how do you ensure that patients feel you exist for them and care about their needs?
Judy, it's crucial to focus on the wants, aspirations, and desires of our patients. As we talked about in previous sessions, we believe in a brief, non-technical case presentation, but the groundwork for that is laid in the pre-exam, initial interview, and the clinical exam talkover technique.
Mm.
It's about addressing their concerns and making them feel heard.
Nice. Speaking of case presentation, you mentioned the importance of gaining case acceptance without pressuring the patient. How do you approach this?
If we face difficulty in gaining case acceptance during the diagnosis, we try to understand the objection, which is so often, since time began, the expense barrier.
Right.
Patients may not be able to afford elective dentistry, and that's okay. Success for us, Lean and Mean and Comfort Dental, is retaining the patient in the practice, not getting the entire case done today.
Hmm. So a patient-centric approach. Can we talk about fees and treatment plans? Because as you said, the expense barrier exists. So how do you strike a balance between presenting ideal treatment and being mindful of the patient's financial situation?
Now, to me, it's about being practical. We make patients aware of ideal treatment options, but tailor our approach to their financial reality.
Mm-hmm.
Shocking patients with huge treatment plans is not the way to go. It's the way our profession goes all too often, but we don't believe that. It's about finding a balance that works for the patients and the practice.
That makes sense. Excellent insights, Dr. Kushner. Now, you touched on patient retention. With this approach, how do you prioritize keeping the patient over completing the entire case?
Patients don't consciously seek inferior dentists. They assume quality. Addressing their three main concerns, and we've talked about this, cost, comfort, and convenience, helps attract and retain patients. Mm-hmm. People do business with people they like, and dentistry's no exception.
Very true. And you also mentioned the importance of patient relations in avoiding malpractice issues. Can you expand on that?
Absolutely. Communication breakdown and the involvement of another dentist. I got to say this, I have to interject. There are dentists out there that are waiting to criticize your dentistry in front of the patient. Believe me, believe me, believe me. And to stray a little bit, in a previous session, Judy, you asked me, why did I create Lean and Mean? And I gave you an answer with two responses. I said to serve the underserved patient and to help the under-succeeding dentist. To show the profession that they got it wrong and we may just have it right. We avoid malpractice by prioritizing patient relations, keeping lines of communication open, and confronting, remember, confrontational tolerance, remember that in the Sensational Seven? Mm-hmm. Any issues that may arise.
Sounds like valuable advice, Dr. Kushner. It's been a pleasure having you on Lean and Mean today. Thank you for sharing your insights on the intersection of dentistry and business.